So, my Jamaica,
the middle way. I was just thinking of making this mandala offering that actually
the Buddha, I've always heard, taught when requested or when somebody asked a question, which I find very provocative. There's this one story in the sutras that always makes me curious and interested. And we don't hear it much for some reason in the Tibetan tradition. They don't talk about this story, but in the Theravada they use this story much more. Talk about this story. When the Buddha attained enlightenment, he got up from the Bodhi tree and he was so profoundly amazed by what he discovered, he thought, I should teach. And so the first man who walked by him, he turned to him and said, I am the enlightened one. And of course, the man turned on his heels and walked away, just like we might if somebody said that to us. And it's a beautiful story about communication. How do we communicate this? How do we talk about this? And it's very profound, I think, that the Buddha taught in response to a question or a request. Because for me, too, here tonight, talking about the middle way, I feel much more like a student, I must confess, which is where I always like to be, because the mind of the student is always open for learning. You know, it's not closed down around an idea, and it's open to the many possibilities. In fact, I think sometimes a good definition of enlightenment might be just a continued opening. In a sense, all the great teachers that I know, including Kenshin Trungpa Rinpoche, seem to be very interested, open, and amazed all the time. And so I think this is very much the spirit of the tradition. And this summer, I was studying a Majjhimaka text. My teacher was teaching to us in Colorado. And I realized, like, the more I study the Middle Way teachings, the Majjhimaka teachings, and this was a text on Nagarjuna, very profound, the more I know, the more I feel in awe of this tradition and of this idea of emptiness. And I just told my teacher, Kongtrum Rinpoche, I said, I feel so humbled by this. And he looked at me and he said, me too. So just to let you know where I'm coming from, it's just a continued exploration. But it doesn't mean that the mind isn't becoming illuminated as it's happening. I feel like there's continued illumination from this material and continued clarity. It's just that it's so deep and vast and profound that sometimes it just leaves you speechless. That's what I was feeling with Nagarjuna's teaching and the commentary of my teacher. So that was very touching. That was a touching moment, a sweet moment with my teacher. And it's very nice to be here talking about Majjhimaka, because I've received many teachings on Majjhimaka from Kenshin Trungpa Rinpoche, who I also consider to be one of my teachers, and a very important one at that. So to be able to serve in this with the Sangha and to participate with the Sangha has a lot of meaning for me. So I appreciate being here. I almost don't know where to begin. I'm thinking, how am I going to do this in 3 days? It's so vast. Now, when we talk about, when we use Majjhimaka, which really just means the middle way, Majjhimaka is a Sanskrit word for the middle way. In Tibetan, it's Uma. 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 U means just middle. So Uma, in the middle way. Also happens to be the name of my horse. But that's because I like Majjhimaka so much. It's actually this, the study of Majjhimaka, there's so many ways you could talk about it, but just one of the ways that I've thought of is that it's really leading you to understanding what we mean when we say insight. What is an insight? What does it mean to be in sane relationship with your world? When we're meditating, what is it we're trying to do, in fact? Where is this place of being completely in accord and at ease with your mind and your world? What is that like? It's a profound clarification of this. This weekend I gave a series of talks. What is it called? Just like a workshop? a week, yeah, retreat, retreat, called Are We Really Practicing? And I didn't talk directly about my Majjhimaka, but it's all about my Majjhimaka because insight is the middle way. So we were trying to discern when we were confused and when we were not confused. And it was an interesting process that worked very well with this group. They were somehow open, and they were questioning me the whole time as I was talking, and we were kind of trying to figure out what this meant, you know. But it's quite true that you do reach a point with your practice, if you do keep practicing, that you start to really discern when you're on and off track. You start to become clear. And as a matter of fact, you develop a lot of confidence. You understand what practice mind is, and you understand what practice mind isn't. It's kind of like I've often talked about it, like wearing a pair of glasses. Before somebody prescribes glasses, before you know you even need glasses, you think you are maybe seeing something. You're seeing clearly. And then all of a sudden you put on a pair of glasses and you realize, oh, those were leaves over there, you know. Like, you haven't been seeing the detail. And all of a sudden you see the detail. So you start, and it becomes clearer and clearer and clearer. And once it becomes clear, then you start to realize, oh, I know the difference. And so you start to pledge your allegiance to the clarity. Do you know what I mean? To the sanity. Pledge allegiance to sanity and clarity. You pledge allegiance to sanity and clarity, you start to experience more sanity and clarity. That's how it works. And perhaps you start to see that maybe you're strengthening your ability to access that more easily, you know? And so sometimes you experience it, sometimes you don't at first, because you haven't developed this kind of muscle, the habit. You know, in Tibetan, gom means habit, developing habit. So you haven't developed a habit yet. So you keep going. And as you get more habituated to being sane, you start to have a choice. You start to be able to make a choice. Do I want, you know, sanity, or do I want... And sometimes you, even when you know you have a choice, you make a choice against sanity. That is fascinating. That's a topic we could talk about too. But we won't get into that tonight. Maybe that's a question you can ask yourself. It's like, why, knowing that I could do it differently, do I continue to choose something that's not working for me? It's very interesting to watch in your own mind. And then eventually you start to have a choice. This is what we talked about a lot this weekend. So you start to have a choice. And then it's just a matter of recollecting, recalling, oh, I'm off, and bringing it back, bringing it home. Allegiance to sanity, choosing sanity, you know? And it's very interesting because once you do that more and more, I think that the mind just becomes so habituated to moving in that direction toward sanity. So instead of your habitual or your default position being neurosis, your default position is sanity. And I once asked my teacher, Kongtrumshi, I asked him, because my grandma had Alzheimer's, and my big fear was always, you know, if one gets Alzheimer's, then do you forget about your practice? Like, I wouldn't want to forget that I have that choice. But my teacher said something interesting. He said that once you're habituated, it just becomes natural. So we need to habituate. Just in case. Just in case. And then you meet people like, and it's very evident after a while, you meet people like Kenshin Trungpa Rinpoche, or Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, or His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and they're just naturally resting there. They're not having to habituate or hold anything or try to get to a view or recollect anything. This is just where they live. And it's very natural. It's very natural. So it's interesting why I'm talking about practice, and I'm supposed to be teaching about Majjhimaka, and people often, sometimes Majjhimaka does not seem to have anything to do with practice, which is maybe why it's good to talk about it, that aspect of it. I think that it actually is a practice, and it's one of the ways we habituate ourselves to moving out of unexamined assumptions and beliefs we have about things. It's a way to emerge. It's one of the ways we can emerge from our ignorance and move toward, it's an illuminating experience. It can be an illuminating experience. And I think the conceptual mind is extremely powerful, as you know. It's kind of like riding a bike. When you're riding a bike, my teacher uses this example. If you look to the right, you go to the right. If you look to the left, you go to the left. So how you think about things and how you define things really shapes your world. I was at Harvard last week. And I gave a talk on faith. And everybody has a very different idea of what is faith. And how you think of faith kind of determines faith is... it can be a belief, you know, a lot of people, I call it the F word, because if you call it faith, people don't come in this culture. People think it's a religious discourse, it's going to be dogmatic, you know, it's going to be, but faith is kind of, can also be seen as like the ability to relax when you don't know, which is pretty much speaks of the human condition. So we have these words, and these words really shape the way we relate to our world and the way we relate to our mind and so forth. So in my Majjhimaka, you're using language to open it up. You're using concepts, and you're throwing darts at your belief system to pop it open. You're opening, you're cracking open and questioning and probing your beliefs. And I'll get into that a little bit. I'll get into that a lot. If this is all about examining and investigating what you believe things are. When we're Buddhist practitioners and we talk about enlightenment, and yet we don't necessarily know what insight is per se. If someone were to ask you to describe it, you might not be sure, and we fall in and out of it, and there's a lot of vagueness around our spirituality. So Majjhimaka does away with that vagueness. Utterly and totally demolishes the vague mind. Because a lot of people feel that if the Dharmakaya or emptiness, it can't be talked about. In one way, that's very true. Words are very limited. For example, if I were to say, describe to you the eggs I ate for breakfast in the morning, or just even describe it to myself, it wouldn't be the same thing as the experience of how I enjoyed my eggs. You know what I mean when I say eggs, but you weren't there, and you weren't me, and it wasn't, you know, you're not eating the same eggs. It's just words are not a direct experience. Words are always inferential. And so, but words are, don't get me wrong, I'm such a lover of words. And what I love so much about words is they're not determinate. It's our determinate structures. Words mean different things in different contexts, always to different people. The meanings change over time. And so they're just a way of just being in relationship with each other. But there's no kind of truth to it. So there's this limitation to it. And I think I'm sure you know what I mean, but we just recited this Heart Sutra, and this is a very interesting thing. It's such a profound text. There's so much going on in that sutra. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's very interesting about the sutra is that the Buddha is resting in a state of samadhi. He's not saying a word. So he's illustrating the fact that actually through words and concepts, we can't have an experience of emptiness, in a sense. However, through some sort of transmission that he's giving to Avalokiteshvara, Avalokiteshvara is saying a lot of things here. So at once it can be spoken and it can be understood, even though I admit that this is a bit cryptic at times. No eyes, no ears, no all that. We'll address that later. But there are a lot of words that explain this. Very profound, very precise, very powerful words that describe the middle way and help us understand at least what something is not and push us toward understanding insight. I really feel very strongly that for us, that for all of us as Buddhists to be very clear about the middle way is very important. Because if you look at all the traditions, of all these Buddhist lineages and traditions, what they have in common is the middle way. What distinguishes Buddhism from everything else is the middle way. And it's so deeply profound. And I think we need to understand it, particularly if we're moving into the Vajrayana, because we're always talking about emptiness, emptiness and luminosity, emptiness and bliss, emptiness and, you know, we must understand emptiness so we don't fall into eternalism and nihilism and just get lost also in this kind of spiritual vagueness. Of course, the emptiness, the experience of emptiness is ineffable. It can't be, we can't really, in a definitive way, describe it, but we can really move in that direction. And then we go into retreat and something clicks. And this whole surge of understanding comes because we've done these studies. I think I've found it very connected to practice. I did a lot of studies on my Majjhimaka before I went into my long retreat, and there's no question that the Majjhimaka studies for me helped me with the practices that ensued on my retreat. And I didn't do any kind of scholarly studies or anything in my retreat. So I have such a passion for this. So I want to share this. I want to make it easier or relate it to practice more, because I find people say, why are we studying this? What does this have to do with liberation exactly? And there's, you know, places in the text where you spend pages and pages of like how a seed, you can't see where a seed becomes a sprout. And a lot of people say, if I have to go another hour listening to how a seed doesn't, you can't connect seed and sprout, like you don't see the relationship, I'll go crazy, you know. But actually, we just have to put it in some context, you know, sometimes. And I know you've all studied some with Trungpa Rinpoche, right? Mm-hmm. Or many people here, maybe not everyone. But anyways, I think there's something also simple about it. But let's just see how we do. I'm going to do my best to talk about it. Maybe just not that Trungpa Rinpoche is not clear, but, you know, we're Westerners and some, we have things in common language-wise. And also, it's just an inquiry we can engage together. So let's see how we do. So the middle way, which is also a synonym for emptiness, those words are used interchangeably quite often, is the sense of genuine insight. And if you were to describe, it's always an interesting exercise to go around the room, and we won't do it just right now, but what is a genuine insight? How would you describe it in your words? Just as something that you've experienced directly. What is a mind at ease, you know? We did that yesterday in this retreat, and it was really, really helpful to listen. I mean, there's a lot of overlap, but how people find words for this experience. I might say, for example, myself, you know, it's what you experience when all the unexamined assumptions and confusions fall away, fall from the mind, relax. And we see that life is not limited to these beliefs we have about it. It might be, I might describe it maybe as the mind that's at ease with its world. When there's just not all this wanting and not wanting and grasping and rejection. You know, a sense of feeling resolved. When all the neurotic attachment and pushing away and bracing against experience, when that all relaxes and you experience the natural vitality of your mind. This term natural vitality is a term my teacher uses. It's just, if you don't have judgments about your experience and there's not all these preferences of your mind, and you're able to just, maybe you have moments of this where it doesn't really matter what comes up, like something's bothering you for a while, and all of a sudden, for whatever reason, it doesn't seem to matter. It's all okay, you know. That sounds like mind at ease with its world, you know. It's a wonderful experience. So when we talk about insight in this tradition, we're not talking about a religious experience or even really necessarily a Buddhist experience, but a very basic human experience. It's a human experience to be at ease with your world. It seems that should be so. And I think people who don't do Buddhist practice have this experience too. So when we look at it this way, you know, it's really easy to understand who the Buddha was and what he discovered under the Bodhi tree. Like, it demystifies something for us. It's not some kind of esoteric, vague, strange thing that we can't understand. I think we can understand this at least to some extent, what that means to be in good relationship with the world around you. And actually, yesterday when we were talking about insight, most people describe that experience as just being something to do with bodhicitta, or the relationships being harmonious or loving, or some kind of thing, you know, being in good relationship with their mind. These are the words that came out. Not being in conflict, not feeling separate. This is what people were saying. So there's this one quote, and I really have to confess, I still don't know what sutra it's from. It may be from the Lanka Avatara Sutra, but my teacher uses this quote a lot, and everybody seems to know it. It's a very common quote from a sutras where the Buddha says, when I attained enlightenment, the whole world attained enlightenment, became enlightened. Have you heard that? Some people have definitely heard it. So when I attained enlightenment, the whole world became enlightened. So this is very interesting, because you might think, well, what does this mean? When I first heard it, I was confused myself. But it has something to do with, because we're not separate from our world. When I say our world, we're the one perceiving it. Like, we all have a different world. We might be here using the same language, but every single person here has their own story. I mean, we have a full history, each one of us, in a way of seeing things, in a system of beliefs, and just the way we even perceive things, and it's changing and it's in flux all the time. So we have our world. So we could be in conflict with our world one minute, and all of a sudden not in conflict. When we're not in conflict with our world looks very different. When we're in conflict with our world looks very, it arises as our enemy, as they say. You know, we're always wanting and not wanting and struggling with it. So sometimes I look at these tankas, you know, and you see the deity in the middle, and you see a lot of activity on the outs around the deity, which is the deity's world. You know, it's all iconography, so it's, you know, it's stylistic and all this kind of thing. But it represents the fact that when the mind is at ease with its world, this is what it looks like. You can't separate the two. When the inside of the central figure of the mandala is at ease, that the outskirts, the activity of the mandala is at ease, and vice versa. So that's what this is saying. So what this says to me is that this is all about being in sane relationship to what you experience. In fact, who can talk about enlightenment without experience? There's no such thing as not having experience or not being in relationship to anything. But we'll get into that a little bit. So, you know, our world sometimes seems like it's on the parameters of outside the parameters of our physical form. But our world can't be separate. If we don't have a perception, we can't perceive an outer world. And if there's no outer world, we will have nothing to perceive. So we're always, that it's all has is connected with the mind, and it's all interrelated. And so we have a lot of difficulties, because we don't sometimes know what to do with our thoughts and our emotions. Sometimes we think the thoughts and emotions are inside in the world of matter or whatever is on the outside. But in fact, we're always relating to our thoughts and emotions as other. You know, it's almost like they come at us and we don't know what to do with them. When we sit in meditation, that's the basic problem, is we're struggling with our experience. Like people sometimes often say, oh, if it wasn't for all these thoughts and all this emotion and feeling, I'd be really happy. But that's like saying, if not for my life, I'd be doing quite well. You know, like, it's all we have is this momentary stream of experience. And that's all perceptions and thoughts and all these kinds of things. So You know, really, if you were to ask me what practice is for, you know, I would say to learn how to be in harmonious relationship with your experience, your life. You know, how do we do that? And I've often talked about, you know, that we have trouble digesting experience. That's good. You know, we know how to eat, to ingest food, and we process it, all the nutrients go to our bloodstream. We don't have to think about it, and we eliminate it. It is very natural, but there's something about being human that's not very natural to us. You know, and that is we don't know what to do with all this experience that we have. So the Buddha, in saying, when I attained enlightenment, the whole world became enlightened, has something to do with this. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I find it very helpful. I find this very, very, very helpful. So in a way, when we're talking about Madhyamaka, we're really talking about relationship. Interestingly, when we're talking about emptiness, it has everything to do with relationship. Which is good news, because emptiness is a very scary word sometimes for people. So never fear. This is about relationship. This is the key word. This is kind of my word for the year, relationship. It keeps coming up. So you might hear it a lot. when we think of the word relationship, we often think, oh, we're in relationship if we're dating someone consistently. Do you know what I mean? That's how we use the word relationship. So it's very limited, you know, it's a very limited way of understanding relationship. But in fact, we are in relationship we are made of relationship. From the smallest kind of cell or you know, like particle of our body is actually still made of parts. And it's in relationship with other things. And then we look at our hand and we see there's all these fingers, but it's all in relationship. You know, there's not one thing here. It's just it's infinite series of relationships. And where do you even find where one thing, you know, ends and another thing begins? It's like I've read on the internet, I was looking up, it's reading something about body work. Because in some descriptions of body work are very interesting. Somebody said, oh, bones don't have a place. They only have relationships. Mm-hmm. You know? There is no one place, you know, for a bone. Everything is always moving and affected by everything else, you know? So we cannot not be in relationship. I was driving last year somewhere, and there's a woman there. We were talking, she was driving me to another center, and she's saying, I like all the absolute practices, but I don't really like the relative truth. Well, the relative truth, it just speaks of the world of relationship. And I don't know how you can do away with that. You know, like, what would a world without a relationship be?
Well, say?
Yeah, no, but not in the emptiness that we are speaking of. Yeah, 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 that wouldn't, yeah, yeah, it would be a void, nothing, like, you can't even imagine it. It's impossible. Just for a minute. Can you think of anything that's not in relationship? Just take a minute. Anybody? Can you think of anything? Yeah. It's so amazing, you know? It's so amazing. The smallest particle to the grandest mountain. When we speak of space, we speak of it in relationship to what isn't space, like matter. Form, thank you. Yeah, to form. So, you know, it's like even if you were to go to a remote cave in Tibet and do a practice, you're still in relationship to the walls. You still have a body. You have to relate to the activity of your mind probably more so than ever. Because there's nothing to distract you. Of course, when you're distracted, you're still relating to your mind. You know, so there's no, you can't imagine anything. You can't get away from relationship, which is wonderful. Because generally, we kind of like to be in relationship. That's why we don't like emptiness, this word emptiness, so much. Because we want to be in relationship. Relationship has kind of this promise of warmth, even though we're struggling with relationship. There's some warmth to it. There's some meaning in it. We live in a world with others interdependently. It's a nature. It's a wonderful word. So in the Buddha Dharma, we often use interdependence or dependent arising, but I think relationship works quite well because it's so personal and we know it so well. And it also makes us question what we actually usually think of as relationship. You know, it's kind of interesting. We think we're in relationship with that one person. But we have all these relationships. Mm-hmm. It so helps to think of it like that. So the middle way, the Majjhimaka teachings, are not only describing insight, but also a method of looking at the world in a very powerful way. And often the method of Majjhimaka or the middle way is called analytical meditation, which is not the most like come hither kind of word, like dental work. It's like who wants to go there? So I understand that that's not, but would try to, maybe we could look at it more as like an exploration or an investigation into our mind and our experience. In some ways, though, I kind of like analytical meditation. Well, it's analytical because we're looking very carefully at something that we don't pay attention to and seeing how it works. And so it's kind of a contemplation. It's definitely a contemplation, but it's also a meditation because the way we're looking is habituating our mind to move out of habitual ways of thinking about things. So, for example, you're probably familiar with in Buddhism, you know, you're examining the self. We hold on to this idea of self as like this separate thing that's separate, that's not in relationship really. Sometimes we can get into that a little bit more. We have an idea of self, who we are, that's kind of static when in fact we're in infinite relationship with everything. So when we start to look at Majjhimaka, we have to move out of that abstract idea. The self is very abstract. If you really try to find a self that's independent and singular, you will never find one. Where is the self, in fact? You know, this is a big investigation on this path. So actually, self is an abstract idea, a singular self that's separate. And yet, you know, we navigate our world so much cherishing and protecting this self. We're in contraction a lot of the time. It doesn't mean there's no sense of being. There's no sense of being. For example, Shanti Deva says in his book, The Bodhisattva Charyavatara, you don't even have to, you know, we talk in Buddhism so much about the self being a problem, but what he says is, oh, you don't have to get rid of the self at all. You don't have to get rid of the ego. All you have to do is expand the ego to include others and make them the recipient of the love and care that you usually reserve for yourself, which is a very profound idea. And it's not just others, it's all relationship. It's it's the infinite relationship that we're connected to. So this one, I think, I don't know who said this, I think it was Glassman Sensei, but a Zen friend of mine told me, he said, below the heavens and above the earth, I alone am, meaning I am with everything, you know? So there is a sense of being, but there's not a sense of separate, independent being. So this is what I mean when this has a very functional practice aspect because we're moving out of abstract into experience through this analysis. A lot of times we do have a lot of vagueness around the words that we use. And even in the Dharma, you know, we use words like emptiness in such abstract ways. For example, you know, okay, so somebody gets pushed down and somebody steals their wallet. And then you walk to them and say, oh, everything is empty. You know, that's not relating to the situation. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like that. You know, somebody has a great loss and you say, oh, everything's impermanent. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is, of course. But we are in relationship. How do we relate to that? You know what I mean? So words can really be very abstract, and we need to continue to examine who we are in relationship and use words that are appropriate or can speak to the situation. And another thing about Majjhimagga, which I find really interesting, is that, you know, a lot of times when we're doing an analysis, things get more and more complex. In science, things tend to get more and more complex. They just keep finding other things, quarks, strings, I don't know, all kinds of things they find in there. Of course, they're not sure about them. They're just speculating. And then, you know, the yesterday's thing is disproved and the new thing. But here, the analysis leads you to a place of utter simplicity. So it might seem a little nitpicky at times, but in fact, where you arrive is a simple place. We want simple, don't we? It's a very particular place. It's a middle way place. Where they say the middle way, there's no conceptual elaborations. You see just what it is, just dead on, without falling into mistaking how things really are. It's like natural. You see things directly, not through a lens, you know, the lens of your own belief systems or your own confusions. So therefore, so wonderful in that way. But it is a tradition of probing, as Aryadeva, who is a disciple of the great Nagarjuna, who is the main proponent of the middle way, said, the moment we begin to ask questions, we begin to question that things may not be as they seem, the whole fabric of our delusion starts to fall away. This is a very famous quote. So we are provoking. We are provoking our ordinary way of thinking about things. And arriving at a place of incredible certainty. And that's what happens. Now, I'm making a lot of promises, I guess. But I hope that this... Okay, so I better stop making soon, or I'm going to get into trouble. But when you have a clarity about the way things are, then you really do start to see when you're on and off track in your practice and in your thinking. So, and it's a little bit like I've been using this analogy lately. You know, if you have a strong core, you know, from exercise, like athletes have a strong core, then the rest of your body kind of finds balance. So this is for our practice, like finding our strong core, having a strong clarity, you know? Yeah. You like that one?
Good one.
Yeah, it is. It's a good one. I think, yeah. It is. No. It is, but it's a good, it really happens like that. So in a way, we're talking about organizing the mind, organizing the mind. I have a lot of notes here. This is really a wading through for me because there's so much that we can talk about. So in a way, you know, one of the things that we're really questioning and we're really probing on this path is a sense of realness. Because we have a sense of things being real. For example, when we're practicing, you know, we sit and we watch our mind, and all of a sudden we have kind of a rough, unwanted experience, so to speak. And immediately we're doomed. We feel doomed. And then the next minute, we have kind of a nice, open, light experience. And then the next minute, we have an agitated experience. And the next minute, we have a bored experience. And each moment, we seem to tighten around these experiences because we have so much preference as to what we want to experience, which is so naive because, in fact, for our entire life, experience has been changing moment to moment. And yet this is what's meant by realness, thinking the self is real, thinking everything is real. It doesn't mean that a lot of people say, oh, it's not real or it's an illusion. It doesn't mean you're not experiencing it or you're having, like, a lot of times when we use the word illusion, we think it's like a figment of my imagination. I mean, it kind of is, but the fact you're, but it doesn't deny the experience or reject the experience. It's just saying that it's very absurd to continuously react to your mind and feel that sense of realness when actually you really might know that it's changing every moment. So you're going up and down and up and down and up and down because we live like this. If we don't question this, we just will live our life continuously reacting. You know, it's like we might get angry at someone you get angry at someone, you feel very right. Anger has that quality of rightness about it. You believe it. It's real. Then, you know, later on you realize, oh, wow, maybe I wasn't right at all, you know? So it's this kind of rightness that's getting us into trouble. And it's this kind of rightness that that we need to start questioning in our practice and in our relationships, you know? And sometimes it's very interesting because we seem to be going along in kind of a rote way, like nothing is changing, you know? Nothing is changing. We get up, we go to work, you know, we have our coffee, we go to work, it's kind of boring, and things don't seem to be changing that much. But in fact, you know, the wonderful thing about the practice is the first thing that happens is we start to see how erratic and changing everything is. And then if you can relax with it, everything becomes very alive, like that deadness goes away. Do you know what I mean? Very alive, like Dzongzhar Khyentse Rinpoche says, don't call it meditation, just call it alive. And I thought that's a great description of meditation and practice. And Majjhimaka does this too. It's saying, oh, you think you know. And you're just going along with all your assumptions. You're cherishing, protecting yourself all the time. I want, I don't want, my preferences. And then you're just contracted. This is poking holes in this tight belief system, this contraction. And you start to feel the world. It's like you're numb. And then you start to look at how everything is in relationship. And it's like you move out of your numbness and you start to feel your world. You know? We do a lot not to feel our world. We don't want to feel our world so much. We feel either we're overwhelmed and scared and we just kind of hold ourselves still and we try to fix everything and manage everything. And I'm not saying don't respond to your world intelligently. That comes from being able to move out of contraction, actually. Or we're just getting overwhelmed by things, or we're just not wanting to look, you know? So all of these practices have to do with our ability to feel in relationship, to see ourselves in relationship, and to wake up and to become more alive. You know, this insight that we're talking about is not just anything. It's extremely specific. So what I want to talk about tonight is the two truths, because this is very basic to the Majjhimaka practice and to Buddhism, and probably most of you have heard about the two truths from Khenchen Trungpa Rinpoche, whoever you study with. So the two truths is a method, really, of looking at experience. It's a way to organize the mind and do the work that we need to do and bring up our views. And the two truths are interesting because, in fact, there's not really any two truths there. We are the ones that separate our experience into two. So therefore, two things. You know, we have the appearance on one hand and the emptiness on the other hand. It's very hard to bring those two together, and I'll get into that in a minute. But that's our doing. Therefore, we're using our dualism to undo it, basically. But the two truths provide us with kind of a model or a paradigm for looking at our confusion. But the two truths are speaking of two aspects of our experience. You know, often think, like, if everything is empty, then how do we discern anything? Or how come it hurts when I poke my skin, you know, if this is empty? So we're not really able to reconcile those two things. So Mipham Rinpoche said, Dzongpa Mipham Rinpoche, the previous one, said we're kind of like an elephant. We roll in the water to wash off the mud, and then we roll in the mud to dry off, you know, as the elephant does. You know, we think, oh, here's appearance, and we're in the world, and we're having to relate to people, and then we go and sit, and we try to find emptiness, like it's something separate, you know. Everything is dualistic for us, you know. This is how we tend to think. So we often do think, like, relative is a problem, and when we talk about renunciation, we need to renunciate the relative. But how can you renunciate the relative? We just talked about that, yeah? It's not something you can get rid of, is the relative. That's why Talopa said to Naropa, son, it's not appearances that bind you, but it's the way you cling and grasp. Mm-hmm. That's what we have to renounce. And part of the renouncing, I read very interesting, just a little while ago, I was looking on my computer, and this woman, Rose Taylor, student of Kenpo Sotsum Japso, she wrote a book that she asked me to endorse, and she was defining a renunciation as emergence. Like you're emerging from... isn't that not what you would think renunciation is? You're emerging from this kind of grasping and rejection, you know, and you're starting to explore and see what works, what doesn't work, what supports enlightenment, what doesn't, you know. I just found that very interesting. I'm not quite sure why she defined it that way, but anyways, it was quite interesting. So we can't renounce the relative truth. So to think of the relative as a problem it obstructs our understanding of this path, and so you know, in so one way, if you're going to talk about the relative truth, you're really just talking about what we were saying, relationship. Because things are in relationship, they're moving, and they're dynamic, and don't. The relative world is rambunctious in the sense that it bursts from the seams of our own ideas. So we're constantly thinking of how things should be and shouldn't be, and it doesn't cooperate with our ideas. It's not rambunctious in the sense that it just, relationship is happening, due to relationship, life is dynamic and so forth. So there's relative truth is not a problem whatsoever. It's just when we hold on, it becomes a problem. So we have this tendency to think we should be able to trust everything, to trust our partners, to trust our spouse, to trust the world, and then we're continuously becoming deceived. It's deceiving, and this is our own naivete again. You know, just so much naivete. It's naivete that things are real. It's naivete that something that's moving and changing and in relationship is trustworthy. And I don't mean this as like that's a problem. It's not a problem. Actually, it's really fantastic. We want to find security, and the world doesn't let us have security in a certain sense. Although there's patterns of things, and things often do work out the way we want them to. But I was saying the other day that what's an interesting exercise for us as human beings is we want security so badly, but imagine if we had it. What would the world be like? Like, try to imagine a totally secure world. First of all, if everything was secure, it wouldn't move, and everything would be inert. So we wouldn't even be able to have this conversation. But, so, okay, say it kind of was secure, so it could move just a little bit. What kind of experience would you have? There would be no surprise. There'd be no creativity. There'd be no challenges. We wouldn't be compassionate because we wouldn't even understand pain. You know, so this makes you appreciate a little bit, you know. It's beautiful that things are moving and changing and that we can't control it. And also we all have a different idea of how it should be controlled, so it's never going to work. So I always think, you know. You know, it's very important to see, in fact, what this points out is that we can't really know anything in a certain sense. Like, we think we can know people, we think we can know who we are, but it's too rambunctious for that. We can't know. And that is so good. And some people say to me, so that we're getting to emptiness, actually. I didn't mean to right away, but it's just, just happening like that. So some people say, you know, with emptiness, okay, I can kind of see how everything's empty and I can accept that. But they say things like, but this notion of evil is hard to see as empty. Like there's some things you can't forgive and just say, oh, it's empty. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I can see why that's hard. Because it's like a dismissal of something. This is sometimes I like to look at this term evil, because evil is really scary and it feels very real. And we feel that if we were to say that wasn't evil, then there's no justice, there's no order, there's no compassion. You know, people, evil people do things to children. Oh, we can't say it's empty. But it's very important to say it's empty, and I'll tell you why. Don't worry, I love children. So I'm not going to say. I often use the example of this movie, Dead Man Walking. Have you seen this movie? So I'll just say, in case you haven't seen it, I find this movie utterly, like, wonderful. Painful, but wonderful. So it's a story about this man who, kind of a young guy, maybe adolescent even, who with his other friend go to, I don't know, find this couple, and they rape the girl and kill the both of them, I think is what happens. And it's very graphic. So you see the whole thing and you feel it's the most heinous thing, you know, you can imagine. And you, throughout the movie, you're seeing the parents and so forth struggling in the pain of the whole situation. So they put the guy on death row. And he has no remorse whatsoever. But then as the movie goes on, so you've already objectified him. You know who this man is. You know. Then they do something very interesting. They bring in his mother. So then you think, oh, he's not only a murderer, but he's a son of someone. And then he's not only a son, but he has brothers. You know, and then you start to see him more and more. You start to see that he's, this is a good word, not one-dimensional, but open-dimensional. Open-dimensional is how Gunther, this translator, Herbert Gunther, translates emptiness. He's empty. The minute you start to question, like Arya Davis said, that things may not be as they seem, that's when your delusion starts to fall away. So the minute you start to see, oh, he's a son, something happens. His mom's crying, he's crying, it's hard to say goodbye, they're about to kill him, you know? Then somehow some compassion comes, you know? And then he starts to reveal himself and open up and become very full, you know? So he is empty of being this one-dimensional, singular, permanent entity. He becomes many, many things at once. And the more you see him, more manyness, the more you can make him open-dimensional, the more compassion you start to get. So, but do you forget what he did? No. Do you relate to the situation? Yes. And yet, you don't close down. You, instead of being bitter, you feel compassionate for this person. So this movie is, I didn't even know why I liked it so much when I saw it for the first time. I just thought it was the greatest movie because it absolutely doesn't allow you to shut down, even when you want to. That's what emptiness does. That's what the realization, and this is what I'm saying. Emptiness means seeing that things are an infinite relationship. So he is empty of being a singular thing, and yet he's infinitely full. And you can see both of these words are limited. Emptiness doesn't get at everything, but fullness too. If you think it's full, you might think he's this thing with lots of things. But in fact, it's neither of those exactly. But you get the feeling because you know the experience I'm talking about, right? Mm-hmm. When you move out of your fixed ideas into a humble place of actually realizing you don't know someone. But that doesn't stultify your ability to discern. It actually enhances it. Then at the end of the movie, you feel your own kindness. And you see the complexity of the situation. And you know, you just can't know everything. You don't know the causes and conditions that brought that together. And you don't know where it's going to go. You know, where these people are going to go and where the families are going to go. The world does not lend itself to being known. That's what's so incredible. And yet here we have this opportunity to be compassionate, and it's possible even in the most evil situation, you know, or, you know, act so heinous as that. So this is why I think emptiness is important for the world, you know. And I get really frustrated that people just think it's some void thing, you know. We can't let this happen. This is our lineage. So this is, therefore, we're doing this, right? Yeah. So emptiness challenges fundamentalism. It really challenges fundamentalism. You know, we think, oh, it's just, you know, Christian fundamentalism or whatever, people holding on to strong. We have so much of that. If we look at a person, even in that situation, and say, and make them only bad, you know, that's fundamentalism. We think we know. We have no humility, you know? So this is where this is very, very needed. Very, very needed. In this way, humility. Look at Trungram Chase, so much humility. He's so learned, but he knows emptiness. Therefore, there's humility, and therefore, there's compassion. So, therefore, there's just compassion. So, when we say two truths, we're not really declaring these two aspects, the relative and the, there's one thing I didn't say. Well, that's okay. Let it go. when we talk about the two truths, we're not really declaring these two things, the relative and the absolute, to be true. It's just a way of looking at them, because we tend to separate, you know. If it's empty, it's dismissing everything. And if it appears and we experience it, that's the other side of it. Do you see what I mean? So because we see in that way, we need to talk about it in this way. But in fact, this is not how things are. You can say that the two truths are actually kind of like water and ice. Water and ice. You can't separate water and ice. You can't even see where water begins and ice ends. They're one in the same, but we know they're also different. They're not the same or they're different. This is very much Eppenkin. Water and ice are not the same, and yet they're not different too. Maybe there's a third way. Oh, the middle way. Yeah. Something like that. So this is the challenge of this, is that we're just not used to thinking this way. We're not used to thinking this way. We're not used to thinking that we can see something that happened that's very heinous and have compassion at the same time. You know, that we can be deeply discerning and yet know that we don't know at the same time. It just all sounds so contradictory. But can you see how it's not, in a way? Practically, it's not. It's just not. We actually experience this sometimes. So we're identifying that. So sometimes, you know, we think of the two truths, they say in the text, like two strings twisted together, like if you have a black string and a white string, and you twist them. But it's not like that at all. It's not like two separate, but it's not one either. So this is like looking through a different lens. We're looking through a different lens. We're not looking dualistically. We're seeing it completely different. Or like there's no lens to look through. We're seeing it directly as it is. And it's very helpful, too, as you can see. So when we talk about the relative truth, you know, we have these different, often it's categorized in the five groups, or as my teacher says, the five lumps. I like this. I'll explain why I like this. Or the aggregates or skandhas. You've heard of that, right? So we have, if we look at our experience, there's roughly five categories we could put it in. The first is like the forms, like the physical world and mental forms that we experience. And then feelings. Well, the feelings are both physical and emotional feelings. Then discernment, there are different words people use, or conception or discernment, means the way we separate or label things. mental formations are impulses or reactions, like states of mind, like faith is considered a mental formation, or drowsiness or distraction, alertness, mindfulness. They list like 51, 52, depending on the book that you read, the text that you read. So these are five ways that we see things. But my teacher calls them lumps. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very helpful to turn them into a verb, because in fact they don't exist as lumps. Everything is made of relationship, but we're lumping. We're separate. We're the ones that are separating. He says lump sum. We could say lump summing. We're lump summing everything. We're dividing. We see things as separate when in fact they're not separate. And again, seeing as separate, it doesn't mean we can't see. I can see that you're different than the woman sitting next to you. It's not denial of that. And yet, when we look a little closer, or I might think you're separate from me, but in fact, we're not one and we're not two. Because when I look at you, I have the perception of you in my mental stream, which is part of me, you know? And I couldn't perceive anything you without you there, and you couldn't be perceived without me perceiving you. So where do I and leave off and you begin? Can you say? We can't with any of this. We are, you know, the food we eat, the air we breathe. Like this is not the parameter of me. We are completely in relationship, or we couldn't move. We wouldn't perceive anything. It's all interdependent, you know. So this is what this is saying. So we tend to lump some. It's like a way of contracting. You know, we don't have to go around thinking, you know, all the time about looking at relationship, because it's kind of infinite. But it's a practice that we do, kind of changes the way we perceive things when we start to ask all these questions about it, like evil or self. We start to, the ego starts to expand, you know, and become more, it's not just a conceptual thing, it's visceral, emotional, physical, energetic, all, you know. And it's not just Majjhimaka that does this, it's all the practices should be doing this for us. So, to understand this conceptually has some power to it. It has a lot of power to it. So relative, you know, here just talks about relationship. And it's not something, relationship is not something petty we waste our time on. It's, you know, this is what we are and who we are, and it's our world. So when we start to question the lumps, basically, this is a very Majjhimakan thing to do. We're questioning the lumps. We're unlumping something. So that's kind of what this is. We unlump our belief systems. We unlump our perceptions. We unlump our feelings that seem so gross and real and true. We look at the causes and conditions for our emotions. You know, we take apart matter. This cup that seems so solid, you know, what is that? You know, somebody pricks us with a pin. This is one argument that comes up a lot. Oh, this must be real, because if somebody, when I get pricked with a pin, it hurts. It must be real. But that's the interesting thing, is what we're saying here is that if it's because of relationship that you feel it, not because there's a, you know, we're confused about this word realness. It's because of relationship that we feel. Not because we're real, but because of relationship that we're real. So, you know, this idea that life is fuller than the ideas we have about it has a lot to do with Majjhimaka. And so it's very important to understand that when we're analyzing things, we're not reducing them to dust. this is not annihilating anything. It's not a form of nihilism, which is the greatest misunderstanding. And it certainly doesn't mean you can do anything. Well, you can do anything you want, but there will always be consequences, right? It does not deny the power of cause and effect. In fact, it enhances that, as we'll get into that more. But anyways, so this open dimensionality, we don't have to worry we're going to disappear in that. said all about everything in my notes already somehow. So what I'm getting at is, so I just talked a little bit about the relative truth, and the relative truth is just speaks of relationship. Now, when we speak of the relative truth, when we start to look at, for example, the open dimensionality of things, we already start to walk into emptiness, right? This is what I'm saying. It's like in that movie, we start to see that, oh, maybe he's not just a murderer, he's also a son. That's 1 foot into the emptiness door. And he opens up, and he opens up, and he opens up. So you can see that, in fact, it's almost as if emptiness and relationship can be used interchangeably. Interdependence and emptiness often are used interchangeably. In Chandrakirti's text, Majjhimaka Avatara, he constantly uses these two terms interdependently. I mean, interdependence and emptiness interchangeably. So this is a very interesting. This thing about relationship is what it is that's going to save us from feeling like emptiness is a problem. You know, we come into the Dharma, and we come into the Dharma because we're trying to find some kind of warmth, you know, some sort of depth to our experience. And then people tell us things are empty, like Gina was saying. Sometimes when beginners come, everything's fine until you start talking about emptiness, and then people start to leave. You know, it's not very inviting. You know, I use the example, it's like, you know, being invited to a party where, in an apartment in a deserted town where there's no heat and food or music, you know, or any, you know, who would want to go? So this, therefore, you know, we have to be clear. This relationship part of it is so important. Okay, this is really where I want to go. So what we really want to do here is unite the two truths, but not unite it like a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and you mix it up, and then it becomes that. It's not that. I think it's already mixed is the point. So because things are made of relationship, they are empty. This is the mantra that we need to do that brings it all into union. That it's kind of a translation of form is emptiness, emptiness is form, but it helps you understand it better. This is, write this down, okay? And this is one of the homeworks for tonight to think about till tomorrow night. It's because things are in relationship that everything is empty. Because of things are in relationship that they're empty. And there will be a second part to this. Maybe tomorrow night or the night after, I'll add on one more sentence. Do you see what I mean by that a little bit? Oh, goody. Yeah. So, you know, you see what happened. We talked about relationship. Therefore, we don't have to say much about emptiness. Because just in talking about what a relationship, how everything's in relationship, we naturally arrived there. So no need to talk about absolute truth so much. So again, there's this interesting thing about water and ice. They're like, relative and absolute truth are like water and ice because you can't separate them. But a lot of people misunderstand that. Like they think the water is the source of ice. Like emptiness is the source of the relationship. But you know, it's funny. I was talking about this once. It's Sogni Rinpoche's teaching last summer, and some guy was telling me that in Finland or Iceland, they think ice is a source of water because all they have is ice everywhere. Yeah. They think ice is a source of water. You can't actually say which is which. Mm-hmm. And this is very interesting. This is this relationship between emptiness and relative. You can't find, one is not, it's not creating. It's like space, you know. Space doesn't create clouds, and it doesn't destroy clouds. It simply is the accommodating aspect that allows everything to move through it and arise and dissolve, and because it's all in relationship. So we think, we always are trying to find a source. This is a big thing in spirituality. Who created it? You know, Brahma, Indra, like in science or like in the Hinayana view, there's particles that comprise everything, because if there weren't particles, how could karma work, they ask, mm-hmm. you know? So these are, like, the arguments in the schools get into this. So, for example, a god or a creator, the argument goes like, arguments, they all are kind of the same. I mean, there's so many arguments and debates that you study in Madhyamaka, but there's this one is very interesting, because it's very simple, too. If God, or if there was a God that created something, then he'd have to be in relationship to create. You can't talk about a creator separate from a creation. Mm-hmm. It's all in relationship. When we create anything, we're moving and we're engaged and we're using materials and whatever, ideas or whatever we're doing. So how, then, in nature, is a God any different than the creation? The God is in relationship, the and always changing and subject to decay and change, and so is the creation. Therefore, logically, then what is so special about this God? Do you see what it is? It's so interesting, no? It's so easy. There's a lot of fancy arguments and words, but all the eternalists have this problem. So when all these eternalists are, talked about in the texts, and it's really cool to do. If you're really into it, you can really engage all that, because it sharpens your mind so much. To have this question and answer, there's no answers, actually, especially in the Prasangika style. Actually, in our tradition, the main tradition that we study, they have these debates with these other schools, like these eternalist or nihilist schools, but they never assert any view. They only ask questions to draw out the faults in their opponents' answers, so they never have this sense of rightness. It's so clever. It's such a protected way. It's such a protected way. And this is why I'm always talking about open questioning, because I'm actually speaking from just this being my background and my passion. It's not like my own idea. It's just a word that I thought people could relate to, and also that helped me understand it. The open question helps me understand. And I love living here in this open question place, because you're completely protected. If you're not right, you're not wrong, but you're engaged and you haven't shut down. Mm-hmm. What a great place, you know? So it's like that. So that's what this is. The mind of an open question is just my way of speaking about it. It's like saying middle way-ing. Making it a verb. Do you know what I mean? Middle way-ing, it's just doing it. Doing the practice of this. So, what time is it? When do we start again? 7?
7.
Oh, so now it's 8:20. We better open it up. So, I'll just have to give some homework, if it's okay with you guys. So, one of the main things I think is very important is to contemplate, and really contemplate it is, it is because things are in relationship that they're empty. That's one thing. And like try to think of how things are in relationship and try to find something not in relationship. It's so helpful. Like you might find a little something here or there. Then you just think it through, or take something and think about how it is. Like with my son, I used to play a fun game. Because my mother-in-law, Rinpoche's mother, used to say that if you want to teach kids Dharma, don't try to indoctrinate them, but just show them how cause and effect works. So we used to play a game where, like, we take an object, like an apple, and we think of all the causes and conditions that brought it in onto the table. And we'd have to go to the person who picked the apple and the person who planted the apple, but then we'd have to look at the person. In the person's family, and then it would branch out and branch out. And this is how we studied, together, my son and I. I studied, too, at those times. So so please contemplate that. And I'm going to do a handout, even. I'm going to do a handout of this really... Let's pass these around. I'll take one, too. I'll explain this to you in a sec. I'll explain it to you right now, even. This is a passage. It's kind of like a poem that I got out of a book called The Heart of Wisdom, written by Thich Nhat Hanh. And it's a very non-threatening way of talking about emptiness. It's very poetic. It's very gentle. Maybe we'll just, you just read it at home and just see what you think, and think of how he's not negating anything, and yet the piece, this idea of piece of paper, your idea of what a piece of paper is changes by the end. Have you read it? It's such a gorgeous way to, it's one of the, my favorite descriptions, or it's almost like an analytical meditation itself. He takes you through a process, through the practice of analyzing. So I thought, what a good handout to have. So just, my main wish tonight is just that you have a sense of the relative and absolute, that you don't feel eternal emptiness is nihilistic, that you understand what's meant by relationship or interdependence. That's my wish for tonight, that relationship. Let's think of how Thich Nhat Hanh brings these two things that we usually think are separate into union in this poem. Does that sound fun?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so that's homework, because three talks is not that much for such a material as this, you know? So rich. So anyways, now we have a little time till 9, right? To do a discussion. You can ask questions, I can respond, or other people can respond, or we can have many people can talk. We can all talk together. I don't want it to make... What I'm actually really trying to say is sometimes I don't want to be seen as the one sitting up here with all the answers. Because I always say, I don't call it Q&A, I call it Q&R, because question and responding. Because I don't believe in answers, because there's no determinate conceptual truth. So that's what I was trying to say.